all know, we are now in the midst of the period of Sfirat HaOmer. And Sfirat HaOmer took on a sad atmosphere because of events that occurred during the period of the Sfirah. The original matter is mentioned in the Talmud, that the Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva died during this period, during the first 33 days of the Omer. And the Gemara says there were 24,000 students who perished during this period of time. From most of the Meforshim in the Gemara say that they died in a plague, a certain type of plague or disease that swept the country. The Ravid in the Sefer HaKabbalah, Rabbi Avraham Ibn Daud, attributes it to the rebellion against the Romans, the Bar Kokhba rebellion, that Rabbi Akiva was a supporter of Bar Kokhba, and that his students participated in the rebellion, in the army, so to speak, and therefore they were killed by the Romans. But in any event, that was a very sad occasion, and that began the custom which exists today of mourning, of a semi-mourning period during the Omer. We don't have marriages, and we don't take haircuts and shaves, etc. People refrain from buying clothing even because of the fact that it is a period of mourning. I want to talk to you about a second reason, that later reason that was advanced, that is a great relevance and pertinence to us. And that is the fact that the Crusaders destroyed much of Ashkenazic Jewry during the period of the Sfira. And the Crusades deserve some study and mention. What were the causes of it, and why did it begin then, etc. There are many works, as you can imagine, written about it, but the basic facts are as follows. For a long period of time, 350 years, from the decline of the Byzantine Empire and its fall to the Muslims, the holy places in Jerusalem and elsewhere in the country were controlled by the Muslims. The Muslims had periods of semi-tolerance of other religions, and they had periods of fanaticism and extremism and complete intolerance of other religions. Now, the Christians had a foothold in the country from the time of the Byzantines. The Byzantine Christians took over the Roman Empire after Constantine, and they controlled the holy places here in Jerusalem. Until today, you have the disputes that go on between the different Christian groups regarding the Church of the Sepulchre. Who has the right to do what, where, and when. It's a matter that has never been settled amongst the Christians themselves. But during the 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th century, the Christians had access to all of their holy places in Jerusalem. And the Muslims allowed them access for economic and political reasons. In the 11th century, you have a wave of fanaticism that sweeps the Muslim world. These things happen in cycles almost. We are unfortunately in the midst of a cycle. And this fanaticism took the form of saying that it was an act of treason almost to allow another religion to practice under Muslim control. So the Jews, to a great extent, were barred from visiting the Temple Mount, but the Christians were prevented from making pilgrimages to their holy places. Or if they were allowed, the cost of so doing, the money that had to be paid to the Muslim authorities was so prohibitive as to really make it almost impossible. Now, well, you have to remember, we're talking the 11th century, and it's not a question of getting on a plane and going anywhere. Long trips, dangerous trips. And because of that, the strongholds of Christianity here in the Middle East began to wither on the vine. Well, that was one problem that the Christian church faced, is how are they going to be able to restore their rights, so to speak, in the land of Israel and in the Christian holy places which exist there. Second problem, different problem that existed, was the structure of Europe, a European society in the 11th century. European society was a feudal society made up of different classes of people. Most people were in the bottom class, were in the lower class, 90% of the population. These people were poor. They were subjected to serfdom, in which they were almost treated as slaves. And they could not just leave the manor. They couldn't do anything. And most of them were illiterate. Almost all of them were illiterate. And they had a very short lifespan. The average lifespan in the 11th century, a person who reached 40 was considered an old man. And the classes that were above them included the noblemen, who had hereditary positions of power and who owned land. And then there were a group of people who were the knights. The knights were basically mercenaries. They were professional soldiers. Their entire life dealt with war and fighting. And when there were no wars, so then they fought amongst themselves. And therefore there was a certain amount of continual lawlessness in European society because of the fact that the knights were unemployed part of the time. So they were always looking for wars, always looking for new adventure, because that's the only way that it justified their position and justified their existence as a class. It wasn't an organized army the way it is today. And the knights roamed Europe in the 11th century, and they caused a lot of problems. Most of them were freelancers. What they did is they hired themselves out to the noblemen. So it was like baseball players, right? So they signed the contract for a year, for 2 years, or whatever it is, and then they got a better offer, they went to someone else. If they got no offer whatsoever, then they became outlaws, they became robbers. Like Robin Hood and his merry men were really, people you didn't want to meet up with. So the question is, what do you do? You had a surplus of all of these armed men running around Europe. And the kings and the noblemen were very distressed over this because of the fact that they were afraid, and justifiably so, that eventually these people would turn against them. And they were not loyal and not able to really inspire any sense of purpose for their existence. So you had these two events. Usually it's a number of factors that create a situation.
I have a question about the third factor. What was the relationship between the Catholic and the Byzantine Church?
Well, we're going to get there.
Okay.
Then there was a another matter, before we get to what Rabbi Heumann said, there was another matter that there was every so often in Christianity, there's a surge of messianism. So when the first millennium came about, just as we experienced the second millennium here not long ago, which also brought there all sorts of predictions and as though somehow there's a magic number in these things. But in the first millennium, many in the church predicted, and in fact based their policies on the fact that the messianic era was coming, and that then the messianic era meant that Christianity would dominate the world. Christianity is an exclusive religion, just as Islam is an exclusive religion. Exclusive religion means that all the other religions, no matter what kind of a good person you are, etc., you're not going to merit the world to come because of the fact that you are not Christian or you're not Muslim or you're not whatever they say you are supposed to be. Has a what?
Has the same idea.
That what?
Not quite.
That what? If you're not Jewish, you're not getting out of Olam Haba.
Well, who says that? Sidei Yumas Olam Yeshlem Chelek Olam Haba. Yeah, and people that observe the Sheva Mitzvahs B'nai Noach we're not in the school. It's not Kol Yisrael either, you know. I mean, it depends how it ends up, right? Right. But the Talmud and all Jewish thought is replete with the people who are not Jewish, who are considered to be righteous people and good people, and who have the souls and spirit, and who are entitled to come to the world to God. Exceptions, you know. I can't judge God, right? I don't never made the count, you know. I didn't make the count amongst us either, you know. There's no way to know these things, Stanley. But the concept is there, right? There is a concept, right? That you don't have to be Jewish in order to enjoy Levy's rye bread, right? So that concept exists. And which is a concept that does not exist in the other two monotheistic faiths, which are exclusive.
Nor do we try to proselytize like those.
That's a corollary, because you don't have to be Jewish, so therefore you don't have to proselytize. The other faiths must proselytize,
right. Simply
because of the fact that the only way that you can get there is through them. And therefore, you know, they're doing you the favor that they give you a chance to get there through them. So you had this messianic fervor, which is always a dangerous thing. And then finally you have the point that Rabbi Heumann mentioned, and that is that there was extreme enmity between the Eastern Church, the Byzantine Church, and the Western Church, was the Roman Catholic Church. The split occurred yet in the time of the Roman Empire, The Roman Empire itself split into Eastern and Western empires. The Byzantine church was concentrated in Constantinople, in Istanbul, and it differed greatly than the Western Church. The Western Church had a pope. The Western Church had celibacy. The Western Church claimed supremacy. The Eastern Church never agreed to it. Until today, you have this split in Christianity. There are many splits today, because then the Protestant movement came and all of the different sects. So there are hundreds of different sects within but you have, as he pointed out, the calendar, for instance. The Western Church established the Gregorian calendar in the 16th century, and the Eastern Church kept the Julian calendar. There's a difference of 11 days. All sorts of differences, differences in ritual, differences in everything, but it's also differences in power and wealth. And when you combine that with the theological differences, you have a very volatile mix. Anytime religion gets involved with all of these other things, then it becomes a most of the wars in Europe were religious wars until the 19th century. They're basically religious wars. And the problem with a religious war is that it becomes a Mohammed mitzvah, right? It becomes a mitzvah to destroy your opponent because he's a heretic, because he doesn't have the right faith. These things are far more vicious many times than, so to speak, the regular wars, which are wars for trade and territory, and somehow can be compromised. Religious wars are very hard to compromise because of the fact that if I'm right, then you're wrong, right?
So,
right. So this is the relevance today to us, is that in spite of all the denials and the wishful thinking, basically it is a religious war that's going on. The West does not represent itself as Christianity per se, but the West is being attacked by the Islamic fundamentalists because of the fact that Islam has to take over the world, and any means are justified, and because of the fact that that's what religion does. Religion justifies terribly irreligious acts, because then it becomes a higher purpose for you to do it. So we see that we see it in the smaller ways, but we see it even within our own society, that differences within the Jewish people lead to very terrible disputes, often even to violence, because we're not willing to, so to speak, compromise our ideals, our religious beliefs. Religion is a very strong motivation for this type of behavior. So you had these factors, the factor that the Muslims were excluding the Christians from their holy places, the fact that this is you had a large number of unemployed armed knights roaming around Europe, you had a time of messianic fervor, and you had this great competition between the Western Church and the Eastern Church for domination of the Christian world, and for everything that's implied in that domination. All of this combines so that the middle of the 11th century, there are people who arise. First of all, there are great struggles with the Pope. The kings and the popes never got along, because the popes then had temporal power. The popes owned land, they owned much of Italy, The popes had an army, not like they have today, 100 Swiss guards, but they had real armies, and there were pitched battles. Kings tried to encroach upon the papal territories. The papal territories tried to increase the territory that they had. They had all sorts of these problems that went on within the church itself. And the popes were accused of corruption. They were accused of not being the holy representatives of the church that they should have been. All of this led to a fact that within Christianity itself, there were monks and priests who demanded a cleansing of the house. The precursor to what Luther would do 5 centuries later. One of them said, how come the popes don't do anything regarding the Christian holy sites in the land of Israel? The popes don't care. They're willing to let it be. And therefore, there was a grassroots movement. There was a Peter the Hermit and Bernard of Clairvaux and others who preached that the people should take the Holy Land in their hands. And the pressure on the Pope was of such a nature that he eventually succumbed to it. And they proclaimed a crusade. And the crusade ostensibly was to free the land of Israel and the holy places from Muslim rule and bring it under Christian rule. Then it was also advertised that once that happened, then all the messianic ideas could be fulfilled. That once there was full Christian domination of the Holy Land, so then the matter of the Messiah and the Second Coming was going to happen right away. So they had that added element to it. Now, who volunteers for the Crusades? So, different classes. There are kings that want to go because it's a war. There's a tremendous amount of wealth and power involved that can be gained. And you had in the Middle Ages all sorts of fanciful ideas. You had the cities built out of gold. You had all diamonds and pearls that just fell in the gutter. All sorts of fanciful ideas, which in that time were held to be true. And just as later in the time of Marco Polo in the 13th century, so he comes back, so they don't know whether to believe him or not, because the stories are so, his description of Kublai Khan's palace and everything that goes on in China. All of this whets the appetite, and the kings figure out that this is the way to get rid of all of these knights. This is how we get them out of Europe. So to speak, we'll do something constructive with them. And what we'll do is launch them on this crusade. And the crusade organizes itself. And in early 1096, now the crusaders also, aside from the knights, the Pope offered the absolution to anybody that went on the crusade, meaning that no matter what your sins were, just participating in the crusade would be a sufficient forgiveness that you would come to the world to come. There were a lot of people in the Middle Ages, the world to come, heaven and hell, were real places. In modern society, they are not. Even for people who speak about them, but they don't occupy the place in our lives that they occupied in the lives of people living in the Middle Ages. And in the Middle Ages, it was therefore a great boon to be able to have all of your sins forgiven in one shot by participating in the Crusades. And since there were a lot of people with a lot of sins, you know, so the tzaddikim didn't go. I always mentioned that in the Torah we read that in the Jewish army the Kohanim would announce Mi Isha Yorei Veracha Levov Yelech V'Yoshev Lebeiso. Whoever is afraid, let him go home. So the simple explanation is he's afraid, Rashi says, Shelo Yuchal Lamud B'Kishrei HaMilchoma. You can't, you know, he can't deal with the terror of war. But the Gemara extends it. The Gemara says, Mali, Yorei means Yorei Mavonosov. He's afraid of his sins. And because of his sins, he is convinced that, so to speak, that there will not be any divine protection for him. And the Gemara extends it even, what kind of sin are we talking about? That he speaks in davening between Borchu and the next Brocha of Yotzer Or of Orei Choshech. So that pretty much cuts the army down to not too many, right? But in Jewish thought, the army is supposed to be composed of righteous people. People who are not afraid of their sins. And here in the Crusades, we have a whole army that is composed of people who are looking for absolution for their sins. And that the sins were probably major sins. In effect, what you have is a tremendous collection of the riffraff of Europe.
What?
People who were had all sorts of ulterior motives for going. They were also promised, again, as Rabbi Yuma points out, they were of a promised great deal of wealth, booty, fortune, because, again, you've got all these fabulous cities that have so much wealth to them, and, you know, and we're going to take them, and it'll all be... And so people came, you know, literally with the... Today we'd say with luggage, with suitcases, but then they came with bags, with baskets to be able to carry it all home. And all of this was real. And it was a rabble. It was a really a group of people who were ungovernable, who were there was no strategy, no one to lead them. Now, the question is, how do you get there? You start out in France and Germany. How do you get there? How do you get to the land of Israel? So there were a number of methods. One was by boat to march down to the ports of the Mediterranean through Provence and embark on ships. And the ships would take them to the coast of Syria and to the coast of then Palestine. But the preferred route, the one that most of the Crusaders used, was going by foot, walking across Europe. It's a question of months. And those that went on foot are the ones that are culpable in the tragedy of the Jewish people in the events of the First Crusade and the Second Crusade as well. In fact, of all the Crusades. Godfrey of Bouillon, who was a French nobleman, leads the French contingent. He eventually will become king of Jerusalem. His brother Baldwin will also become king. They are both killed and die in the land of Israel. There's a famous legend, you know, Rashi's legend, that the Rashi told Godfrey of Bouillon that he would only return with three horsemen back to France, and that's all that would be left, two horsemen rather, and Godfrey came back with three, and as they entered the city, the arch fell on one of the horsemen and killed him, so that Rashi's proclamation, his prediction, was to be proven accurate. That's a legend because almost proven historically that Godfrey never came back and that he died in the land of Israel. And it's never proven that Godfrey and Rashi ever met either, for Rashi to tell him in advance what was going to happen. But legends have their place. They characterize events. And the legend is a form of Jewish revenge against the Crusaders. The Crusaders march. And on the way, on the way they're hungry. The Golden City hasn't appeared yet. They're in the middle of France somewhere. So leaders of the Crusades say, in order to control the mob, they say, why do we have to go all the way to the land of Israel to kill infidels? We got infidels right here, right? We got our own. We don't walk 2,000 miles in order to fight the infidels when we have infidels living within our own communities. The infidels that they are referring to were the Jews, because the Jews were practically speaking, the only minority in Christian Europe. Everybody else was Christian. And the tribes were long since forcibly converted to Christianity. So the Jews were the odd people out. Now, the Jews were defenseless because of the fact that in the Middle Ages you lived at the sufferance of the landlord, of the man that the nobleman of the manor, and you lived under the protection of his knights. And when that was withdrawn, so then you literally were defenseless, no matter what happened. And because of that, you have a spotty record here of communities. Now, the Jewish community is very small. The Ashkenazic community, the time of Rashi, is probably no more than 300 to 400 families. And everybody intermarried with each other. And because of that, that's why we have, unfortunately, these genetic diseases that exist in Ashkenazic Jewry, because we have a very small DNA base, even though we're millions of people. But the basic genetic stock is very limited. And after a while, what started out as recessive genes, or bad genes, so to speak, in certain cases, turn out to be... we have today programs, especially in the United States, but here in Israel as well, to try and eliminate all of these terrible diseases, Tay-Sachs, Gaucher's disease, other types of diseases, from amongst the Ashkenazic Jewry. There's a Jew in New York by the name of Eckstein, a wonderful Hasidic Jew, who lost, God forbid, a number of his children to Tay-Sachs. And he has devoted his life to creating a system by which every potential chosen and every potential kala takes a blood test, given a computer number, and before they go out, before a shidduch date, etc., the numbers are given in. And if the numbers, God forbid, match, in other words, if there's a high probability that they're both carriers, so then the shidduch date never occurs. And because of that, over the last 20 years, the incidence has dropped dramatically. And it's been expanded for other diseases as well. One of the great things of modern technology, that to spare families this terrible trauma. But in any event, there are a small number of Ashkenazic Jews, and the truth of the matter is that the Crusaders didn't kill that many because there weren't that many to kill. There were less Ashkenazic Jews than an hour's worth of work at Auschwitz.
But how many Crusaders were
Christian Crusaders? Estimates vary between 20 and 40,000. a lot of them, you know, it wasn't that you saw, a lot of them dropped off, a lot of them joined in. It's not an organized army that they, you know, that you can really number and control and say who went and who didn't go.
We also were, what, 8-9 crusades by 200
years. Right, right. The crusades last for 200 years. So what happened was that there were certain towns that they came to. For instance, they came to the town of Troas, Rashi's town, where the archbishop lived there, and the nobleman who controlled the town refused to allow them to enter the town, forced them to leave the town alone. And therefore, Rashi is spared and the events of the crusade itself, even though one can imagine that the Jews were badly terrorized. There's a legend again that the Archbishop of Troyes had studied in Mainz when Rashi was in Mainz in the yeshiva, and that the seminary and the yeshiva were like in close proximity to each other, and that the seminarians who in that time had to learn Hebrew and learn the Bible in Hebrew, when they had difficulties, would cross the street, so to speak, to ask in the yeshiva what does it mean. And the legend is that Rashi and this seminarian knew each other, and that the seminarian eventually became the archbishop, and that therefore, because of his relationship with Rashi, and the fact that Rashi had, so to speak, befriended him when he was in Mainz, then the crusaders were not allowed into the city. But the crusaders continued east, and they came to the great Jewish communities on the Rhine, Shum, Shinvav Mem, Shapiro, which is the city of spires, Vermeise, which is the city of worms, and the Mem is Magenza, which is the city of Mainz. Now, this was a tri-community. Even though it was three different cities, it was looked at in the Jewish world as being one community. We had other instances of triple communities. Ahu was a famous one, Altoona, Hamburg, Wandsbek, which was then under, later would be under Denmark and Germany. But Shum was the seat of Torah learning. The great yeshiva in Mainz was founded by Rabbeinu Gershom Maor HaGola, and his disciples were the Rashi yeshiva, and his disciples were the teachers of Rashi. Rashi studied there. There was a great yeshiva in Spires. So this was the seat of Torah learning and of the scholars of Israel, and it was a sizable Jewish community. Sizable, probably no more than 2,000 to 3,000 Jews in all three communities. But it was sizable, A, for its time. We're talking about 30% of Ashkenazic Jewry, and it's sizable because of the influence that it had, because you're talking about a community that had great influence and great attraction to students, etc. In the month of Iyar and in the month of Sivan, during the Sfira period, these three communities were destroyed. Some were destroyed on Shavuos, some were destroyed before Shavuos. And we have a number of keynote of elegies that were written to mark the occasion. We recite them on Tisha B'Av. They're the Ashkenazic liturgy for Tisha B'Av. And and they're called Tatnu. Tatnu is 1096 in the English date and the secular date. It was 4856 in the Jewish date, the date from creation. These cities are destroyed. Now, it raises questions. One of the questions was, many Jews, or a number of Jews, but apparently it seemed to be a number that was large enough to be troubling, converted to Christianity to avoid being killed. Later, many of them attempted to return to Judaism. So you had a difference of in attitude. What was the attitude of the Jewish communities in accepting them back into their communities? So, for instance, we find Rashi as being a very strong defender of the Jews who converted and wanted to come back. And Rashi, in the Tshuvas that he wrote, and in his behavior, Rashi was very, very insistent that Jews should take them back and not, so to speak, hold it against them. However, the masses of the Jewish people were not that tolerant, because they had gone through all of these terrible things. Their relatives had been slaughtered. In many of the communities, the fathers and the mothers killed their own children and then committed suicide rather than submit to the Christians, because they knew that they would be forced to convert. And in order to avoid that, they took such drastic action. Discussed again in the Tshuvas whether or not how proper that was, but the fact of the matter was that that happened. People actually did that, and it was common, for instance, in that time for the Christian world for Jewish children to be kidnapped and to be raised as Christians. Because again, they felt that they're doing the child a favor, etc. And you have many incidents like that. That's where the legend of the Jewish Pope has its foundation. That there was Shimon of Mainz, who wrote the piyut that the Ashkenazim say on Rosh Hashanah for the chakras. So he had a son, Elchanan, who was kidnapped and raised as a Christian. He mentions it in the piyut, in the acrostic of the piyut of the poem. So it ends, Elchanan b'ni yichye le'olam. May my son Elchanan attain eternal life. He's referring to the son that was kidnapped and taken from him. That's right, Elchanan. So the legend was that he eventually became the Pope, and that his father came and visited him, and he revealed himself, and so we had Jewish popes. Whether or not we did or didn't, but again, that was a form of Jewish legend, really a form of undermining the church. But it was common that that's what happened to Jewish children, and therefore to avoid that, and that's what happened in the Holocaust too. To avoid that the children should be killed, thousands of Jewish children were given over to the Roman Catholic Church to be raised as Christians. And you have thousands of them in Europe still. Some are aware, some are not aware. But it's a phenomenon that repeats itself. And so these cities were destroyed. The Jewish communities were destroyed in the First Crusade, and they never rebuilt themselves to their previous glory. Rabbeinu Gershom himself, the Mordechai quotes in Moed Kotten, that Rabbeinu Gershom himself had a son that converted to Christianity, and that the son died. And it says that the Mordechai says that Rabbeinu Gershom sat Shiva for 14 days. 7 days over his death and 7 days over the fact that he had converted to Christianity. That's the Mordechai quotes that Moed Gott. So it was not a rare thing that Jews were forced to convert, or that some Jews may have even just given in for other reasons. And so therefore the Crusades represented this mass attack against Judaism. Tremendous mass attack against Judaism, against Jewish life. And wherever the Crusaders went after that, the Jewish community suffered. We're talking basically about Ashkenazic Jews. When the Crusaders come to the land of Israel, so there are Sephardic Jews here in Yerushalayim, and they are all killed by the Crusaders. Gottfried Bouillon gathered them all in the synagogue and burned the synagogue down on their heads.
What happened to the Jews in Provence?
The Jews in Provence were able to escape most of the depredations because of the fact that they were wealthy, they were powerful, they had good connections with the noblemen, and Provence was a much more sophisticated culture than the rest of Europe, and Provence saw itself not as part of France but as an independent separate country by itself. So we don't find that in Provence the Jewish communities were disturbed to that great extent. Or even in Spain. Now in Spain, the Crusaders wanted to conquer Spain from the Muslims. And really the beginning of the Spanish reconquest, which took almost 400 years to be accomplished, but the beginning was with the First Crusade, when the thin piece of territory in northern Spain, which still was Christian, the Crusaders attempted to expand it and push it south. Again, with the same idea, why do we have to walk 2,000 miles to kill infidels? We can kill them here. But the purpose of the Crusade was not only to kill infidels, the purpose of the Crusade was to take the land of Israel back. And the First Crusade was successful in that goal because of the fact that it did conquer Jerusalem, and that it did establish a Latin kingdom, a Crusader kingdom that lasted for almost 200 years in the land of Israel and Syria and in other places. And you can see the remains of the Crusader fortresses that were built all over the country. But the Crusaders did not have a mass movement of immigration to back them up. And therefore, many of them just took whatever money they had and went back home, and the Europeans didn't come in great numbers, and there would be a series of crusades, the Second Crusade, Third Crusade, there was a Children's Crusade, there was a Pauper's Crusade, and all of them failed eventually. And the Emperor Salah ad-Din, who later was the emperor in Egypt at the time of the Rambam, he defeated Richard the Lionhearted outside Kibbutz Lavi today and the Horns of Chitin, and that pretty much was the death knell of all the Crusader kingdoms. You hear that today from the Arabs and the Muslims, that they say, you know, we outlasted the Crusaders 150 years, so by us time is nothing, we'll outlast anybody else that comes to the country. The difference is the Crusaders had no backup. And the people, the kings, and everybody in Europe, even the popes, lost their appetite for it. Finally, the Crusaders destroyed the Byzantine church. They captured Constantinople and burned it to the ground. Christian against Christian. But they were the wrong kind of Christians. And that pretty much soured any later attempt to somehow reconstruct the Christian church, to reunite it, because you had this, and until today, in spite of all efforts at reconciliation, the churches are badly divided, but that remains in their mind, that they were destroyed by the Roman Catholic Crusaders, not by Muslim infiltration, etc. So that's why the sphere of time became especially a black time for Jews, not only because of Rabbi Akiva and his Talmidim in the 3rd century, but in the 2nd century rather, but also because of the Crusaders in the 11th century, which brought this great tragedy on Ashkenazic Jewry. Thanks.